any sane person will seek for purpose in life. I don't have to tell you this, but of course, if you've had children, even little children from a young age begin asking questions like, why? They start trying to make sense of life, just intuitively, just naturally. The German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche once said, "He who has a why in life can bear almost any how. He who has a why to live for can bear almost any how." And despite Nietzsche's own philosophical atheism and nihilism, his statement resonates with us because we were created as beings with purpose. We were created to live with meaning and purpose. And during his time as an inmate in an Auschwitz concentration camp, Viktor Frankl observed firsthand the difference between life and death in the inmates. As it came to the end of their incarceration there at Auschwitz, many of these prisoners were dying by the day. And yet he remarked that it was those who had a strong sense of meaning and purpose that tended to live and survive. That was all they had. And so he wrote what would become a famous book on the subject called Man's Search for Meaning. And maybe you've read that or heard about that. Meaning is essential to your existence. And those who lose their sense of meaning lose all will to live. You wonder why there's such high suicide rates around some of the richest parts of this world, in the West, namely in Europe and America. Well, that has to do exactly with what we're talking about. You see, unfortunately, millions of people around this globe are living without any sense of meaning or purpose. And even the people of God, you will find, are not exempt. You will discover that many born-again Christians are often struggling with this very thing, with a loss of meaning, with a loss of purpose. It's so universal a problem that Abraham Maslow, the psychologist who came up with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, had this and concluded this. He said, "The story of the human race is the story of men and women selling themselves short." And you know, the Bible is in full agreement with that statement, though for different reasons than Maslow would give, of course. If aliens, I've brought this to the youth before, but if aliens were to look at your life, observing you from the outside, and to study your every movement, to study if they could even record your thoughts and examine your thoughts and your behavior over, say, the last 3 days, what would they conclude drives you in life? What would they conclude about your life purpose, your purpose for existence? Would your behavior exhibit a clearly defined purpose? Do you have a strong why in your life that is strong enough to get you through anything? Do you live day to day with a strong sense of personal meaning? And is that meaning consistent with what you believe about the Word of God? Or would it be consistent with some other contrivance of your imagination? These are all questions which the book before us addresses. It is a book about vanity. It is a book about meaninglessness. It is a book for our time. I think its incredible relevance to the 21st century will become more evident as we move through its timeless verses. But please notice our text, Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 1 and 2 this morning. We read in the Word of God, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king of..." Am I on? Okay. "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, vanity of vanities," says the preacher, "vanity of vanities, all is vanity." I want to primarily focus on two questions from out of our text. The first is, who is the preacher of this book? And secondly, what is the substance of his message? How does he introduce the substance of his message? First, who is the preacher of this book? Well, the book opens with this introduction, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Israel," or king in Jerusalem. The author nowhere gives us his name. Instead, he gives us a title for himself, the preacher. It's a Hebrew word, koheleth, that appears 7 times in this text. And it is one who literally calls out or addresses an assembly. So that's why it's translated in our Bibles, the preacher, or you could say the teacher. Well, who is he? He never gives us his name. He never really identifies himself by name. But there are several clues in this book for discovering the identity of the author. First of all, he identifies himself as the son of David. And that obviously would narrow it down for us quite a bit. One of King David's sons. In addition, the author's identity is discovered as king over Israel and Jerusalem. He is a king in Jerusalem. Now, we know that when the kingdom split under David's grandson Rehoboam, there was a northern kingdom of Israel, and they moved their capital to Samaria, and the southern kingdom of Judah remained, their capital remained in Jerusalem. So whoever this king was, he is certainly not a king of the north. He would either be a king of the south or a king before God's kingdom split under Rehoboam. And if you continue reading through the book of Ecclesiastes, and I'm not going to show you all these texts just for sake of time, but there are several more clues we come across for who this author is. In verse 16 of chapter 1, we see the author's unrivaled wisdom. He was a man of unsurpassed wisdom. In chapter 2 and verse 7, we see he was a man of unequaled wealth. In chapter 2 and verse 3, we see his great opportunities for pleasure. And in verses 4 and through 6 of chapter 2, we see his extensive building activity. I think all of this really points uniquely to one man that we know of in Israel's kingly history. And that is King Solomon, the son of David, who was wiser than all. The son of David, who is the greatest king of all. The king who would bring Israel to its very zenith of glory and power. Even in chapter 12 and verse 9, the author claims, or the preacher claims, to have written many proverbs. And if you know anything about Solomon, you know that he wrote the book, or at least most of the book, of Proverbs. So it's possible that somebody is writing in the persona of King Solomon. Some scholars have thought that, some conservative scholars. I'm not going to debate that, but all these things certainly point to Solomon himself as the author of Ecclesiastes. And I would also reason with you that I don't believe God could have picked a better candidate for the book we're looking at. A book on pleasure, a book on the meaning of life, finding true satisfaction in life. I don't think God could have picked a better candidate than Solomon himself. I'd like to show you why. Just in order to appreciate the book of Ecclesiastes, we need to understand the man behind the book. Now, back last year, when we looked at the first 9 chapters of Proverbs, I did begin by giving you a survey of Solomon's life, just in a nutshell. And so we're not going to look at this in great detail, but I want you to get the big picture of the kind of a man Solomon was and why he uniquely qualifies as the best candidate for this book. The scriptures unfold Solomon's life as a king in 3 stages. Well, technically, you could say 4 in total. The first stage of Solomon's life is recorded in 1 Kings chapter 3. And if you'd like, you could turn over there with me. 1 Kings chapter 3, we see Solomon becomes the wisest of all. He becomes the wisest of all. We read in 1 Kings chapter 3 and verse 3, "Now Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David, except he sacrificed and burned incense on the high places." Here we see Solomon imperfectly and yet genuinely loved Jehovah God. He loved the Lord. And the genuine nature of his love is seen in the fact that he was walking in the statutes of his father David. But the imperfection of his love is evident in the very next clause, in that adversative clause, "except he sacrificed and burned incense on the high places." God was not pleased with everything in Solomon's life, but of course, no believer's love to God is perfect, right? And the Lord, it is true, loved Solomon before he was even born. We see that in Solomon's life. It's a precious thing. But nevertheless, in verse 5 of 1 Kings 3, we read, "In Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream at night, and God said, 'Ask what you wish me to give you.'" God graciously and incredibly gives Solomon the wish of his choice. Kind of like a dream too good to be true. And what an opportunity. What did Solomon say? How did he respond? Well, this has to be one of the most precious things a child could say to his father. Look in verse 6. "Then Solomon said, 'You have shown great loving kindness to your servant David, my father.'" And verse 7. "Now, O Lord, my God, you have made your servant king in the place of my father David, yet I am but a little child. I did not know how to go out or come in. Solomon is saying to the Lord, I feel so inadequate. I feel so unable for the task. I cannot measure up to what you're calling me to do, O Lord. So verse 9, he says, give your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, to discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours? I'm sure Solomon, to this point in his life, had the best training possible, the best training available. He would have likely been at least 20 years old as the heir to David's throne at this point in his life. And he had been trained much in the art of war and strategy and rulership. He was the one that David and the kingdom was grooming to rule over this united monarchy of Israel. And yet he says to the Lord, I'm inadequate. I'm not able. This is not an expression of his unbelief in God's help, but it is Solomon's firm belief in his own inability, his own weakness. This is a quintessential expression of humility. Humility. I need you, God. And it's what each one of us needs for whatever God calls us to do. So the Lord gives to Solomon the most incredible wisdom. You can go on to read about that in the chapter. And listen to 1 Kings 3 and verse 28. When all Israel heard of the judgment which the Lord, which the king had handed down, they feared the king, for they saw that the wisdom of God was in him to administer justice. And this really ushers Solomon into the next stage of his life. We've seen he becomes the wisest man in all the world. This is really how it happened. But in stage two, Solomon, by right of his wisdom, by right of God's blessing upon his life, becomes the wealthiest man in all the world. And we see that in 1 Kings chapter 4. If you skip down, we could look at the chapter. But in 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 29, we read, now God gave Solomon wisdom and very great discernment and breadth of mind like the sand that is on the seashore. And Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the sons of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. And I could keep reading, but you get the idea. He becomes famous. And in 1 Kings 10, in 1 Kings chapter 10, several chapters later, the Queen of Sheba, that is this ruling monarch of the southernmost Arabian Peninsula, travels afar all the way north to Jerusalem just to visit Solomon because she wants to see with her own eyes, is it true? Are the reports true of his wisdom, of his splendor and glory? And she concludes, I heard a lot of spectacular things about you, Solomon, but the truth is the half has not been told. She was blown away by the glory and the wealth and the wisdom of this king. And just read 1 Kings 10, 14 through 30, and you will be impressed with the glory of Solomon's reign. In fact, if you take those verses literally, as I do, you will have to conclude Solomon was one of the richest men to ever live in history. One of the mightiest men to ever live in history, certainly in his time. And so he had all that he could wish for. And you wish that was just the end of Solomon's story. It ended that way. But unfortunately, he departs from the wisdom that God had given him in the pursuit of worldly pleasures. He's a man who went searching for meaning in these things outside of the will and wisdom of God. And so we come to a third stage in Solomon's life, and that is his demise. Solomon's demise. In 1 Kings 11, in verses 1 through 8, we see the story of how he took to himself many foreign wives. The problem with that was that with these wives and all of the immorality that he began to be involved in, he began to follow after their pagan religion and their pagan practices. In 1 Kings chapter 11 and verse 4, we read, when Solomon was old, as he became older, his wives turned his heart away after other gods, and his heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. And if you skip down to verse 9, you'll see that while God disapproved of his immorality, it was ultimately Solomon's idolatry. It was his heart that was the real problem. Look at what the scripture repeatedly emphasizes. Verse 9, the Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart was turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel. The ultimate evil was not even the sexual immorality, the rank amount of immorality that this king of Israel was involved in, and what a terrible example that was for God's people. But ultimately, all that was just a symptom of Solomon's wayward heart. And how could such a wise man behave so foolishly? Well, two warnings here, beloved, this morning. First, no one, regardless of how wise, is ever above falling into sin, falling into the same foolishness of this wise king. And secondly, wise living today does not guarantee your wise living tomorrow. You could be serving the Lord. You could be at what you see is the closest point in your life with Jesus Christ. And that doesn't mean you're one step away. Take heed. Let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall, the Bible says. So we've seen that Solomon has come to be the wisest man in the world, the wealthiest man in the world, and then his demise. He falls, and God says that your kingdom is going to split under your son. And some have said that Solomon never repented. Some have said there's no other stage in his life, that he goes out as an apostate king. And as such, they would suspect that he was never truly numbered among God's redeemed. But here's my question to such. What about the book of Ecclesiastes? What about the book of Ecclesiastes? I think we find in Ecclesiastes a final stage, a fourth and final stage in the good king's life. And it is a stage that represents his confession, his repentance. This book before us, now you can go back to the book of Ecclesiastes, if you will, is not the confession of a king who left off any and all belief in God. It's the confession of a man who's wasted his years of living as though God were not. And we find here in the book of Ecclesiastes the agony of regret. So he writes most directly to the youth of this world, those who have most of their life ahead of them. And he concludes, remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before it's too late. What better candidate could God use to write a message to you and I about meaning and purpose and true pleasure and happiness in life than this man? This man who at one point had it all and lost it all. You can see how God directed Solomon to write this near the end of his life, because this book reflects a very cynical perspective. It's a perspective seldom possessed by any young man. It is a book essentially that is a reflection on days past, when the writer once lived on top of the world. The writer assumes the role of the elder who gives testimony to the younger. And we see that especially in his concluding address, to remember our Creator in the days of our youth. And finally, given the entire story of Solomon's life, as you read about that in the book of 1 Kings and his tragic wandering from God, you can see the king evidently wrote this after repenting. He has a change of heart, repenting from his waywardness. And so we can date this book reasonably to the final years of King Solomon's life that would fall, I'll say, sometime between 940 and 930 BC. All right, that's the preacher of our text. That's who's writing to us. That's who's the man behind the book. The next question for our text this morning is, what is the substance of his message? What's the substance of the preacher's message? Well, look at verse 2. This is how he begins. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Well, you just have to ask, what is vanity? What is vanity? The Hebrew word hevel occurs almost 40 times in this book. So this is a critical word. If you don't understand the word vanity, hevel in Hebrew, you won't understand the book. And I think there's I could say, almost three-dimensional idea to this concept of hevel, of vanity. It's not just a single, simple concept. The first concept associated with this idea of vanity in Ecclesiastes is that which is transient, that which is fleeting, that which is here today and gone tomorrow. As an example, Ecclesiastes 6:12, we read, for who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime, during the few years of his futile life. That's the word vanity there. He will spend them like a shadow, for who can tell a man what will be after him under the sun? The largest ice palace was once built in America in a place called Leadville, Colorado. Never heard of it, but until now. November 25th, 1895, they laid the cornerstone for this huge Ice Palace in America in an effort to bolster the town's sagging economy. They needed to bring in tourism and money. And so the citizens staged a winter carnival. And on New Year's Day of 1896, the whole town turns out for a grand opening to the world's largest ice palace. The immense palace measured 450 by 320 feet. Towers that flanked the entrance were 90 foot high, and inside was a 16,000 foot skating rink. But by the end of March, the palace was melting away, along with the hopes of Leadville, Colorado. You see, all these tourists that came, they came, but they had spent very little, and it didn't accomplish what these citizens really wanted it to. What a great picture of vanity. That which is here today, gone tomorrow. The splendor of an ice palace that is melted into a stream. The book of James talks about our life being like a vapor of steam. He says you are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. That's the image of vanity Solomon's after. But there's another dimension to this idea of that which is fleeting, that which is transient here today and gone tomorrow, and that is also that which is meaningless. Vanity, hevel, is that describing the apparent meaninglessness of earthly life. In Ecclesiastes 2:17, Solomon says, after all these pleasures he's indulged in, so I hated life, for the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is futility and striving after the wind. Wow, what an image. In addition to the transient concept of this term, there's a dimension that involves futility. And life essentially void of any meaning and purpose. It's like Sisyphus in Greek mythology, who's doomed to forever roll that boulder uphill, right? And when he gets to the top, what happens? It falls. And he's got to go down and through all eternity do this meaningless, pointless labor. And many human beings have felt about life this way. The tennis star Boris Becker was at the very top of the tennis world, and yet he was on the brink of suicide. He said, I had won Wimbledon twice before, once as the youngest player. I was rich. I had all the material possessions I needed. It's the old song of movie stars and pop stars who commit suicide. They have everything, and yet they are so unhappy. I had no inner peace. I was a puppet on a string. And Becker is not the only one to feel that way, to feel that sense of emptiness about life. The echoes of a hollow life pervade our culture, and you don't have to read many contemporary biographies to see that this is a pattern. This is a reality all over Hollywood, from the West Coast to the East. Jack Higgins, the author of such successful novels as The Eagle Has Landed, was once asked what he would like to have known as a boy. And his answer was this, that when you get to the top, there's nothing there. That's a picture of the word vanity, futility, striving after the wind, everything under the sun. That which is meaningless, that which is transient, these are dimensions to this concept of vanity. But there's a third, I believe, that we can take note of as we go through Ecclesiastes, and it is that which is unknowable, that which is beyond human comprehension. Ecclesiastes 2:19, Solomon says, and who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? Yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor, for which I have labored by acting wisely under the sun. This too is vanity. Solomon was troubled with the thought that when he would die and go off the scene, he had no control over his life. He had no control over his possessions. He didn't know anything that would happen after him. It was out of his hands. And that's a third dimension to this concept of vanity. It involves incomprehensible mystery. It's the idea that in this earth, in this life, materially speaking, physically speaking, you're not guaranteed anything. Yes, you could read the optimism of Proverbs, and there is a reality to those principles that God blesses the wise, and the righteous are blessed, and the wicked will not prosper. But you understand that that is a principle, and that is ultimately true spiritually. And the Bible does not teach a health, wealth, and prosperity gospel. There is a great uncertainty to life. Life is an incomprehensible mystery. God alone is sovereign and omniscient, and all my life, all your life, on this earth is a constant, mysterious, incomprehensible flux. And that is what Solomon will describe as vanity. So you see, this word vanity is not so simple to define. It's actually a very loaded term. It describes life as fleeting, pointless, and elusively incomprehensible. Now, Solomon raises two striking things about vanity in his opening statement, or his, we could say, opening synopsis. We see first the absolutism of vanity. He says, vanity of vanities. Vanity of vanities. What kind of a person would you imagine ever saying something, ever beginning his treatise so dark and cynical? Well, I kind of think of maybe a survivor of war. Maybe one who's seen the ravages of war, what human society is truly capable of. Maybe a Holocaust survivor, like Viktor Frankl, right? Or somebody who's lived all their life in a Russian gulag. Maybe one racked by illness, disease, or one who loses all strength and ability to some terrible physical disability. Sounds kind of like something that somebody would say, all is vanity, vanity of vanities. Maybe somebody like Job, who lost everything material and physical in his life on earth. See, it sounds as if the wise preacher has come to the ends of his life. These are not the words of a young romantic. They're not the words of one intoxicated with all the pleasures of life and merriment of youth. Here's a man who's been around the block. He's tasted everything heart could wish, and he's come up empty and dry. And so, having come into the world with nothing, and then felt as though the entire world had come into his hand, now the writer comes full circle and he says, vanity of vanities. He can't help himself but to begin so abruptly and so absolutely, vanity of vanities. All is vanity. And there's also here another idea along with the absolutism of vanity, and that's the universality of vanity. He says, all is vanity. And I think it's important to distinguish. The writer is not supposing that the works of God themselves are vanity, but rather what sin has made of God's works, how it has marred God's creation. It's like Paul talked about in Romans 8:20, for the creation was subjected to futility, vanity, meaninglessness on account of sin, of course. This understanding of vanity focuses on the effects of sin's curse on physical creation and our existence in it. And so the universal scope which the preacher has in mind addresses, he's going to define it as limited to everything under the sun. And as we're going to see, that is talking about life on this earth. Earthly life. Ultimately, earthly life without God. Now, having considered these first two verses, I think we're in a position just to consider in a few moments the debate over Ecclesiastes. And it's really this. Are these the words of a pagan philosopher or the words of a saint? And that is actually something that scholars have discussed. There are different views on this book. Traditionally, the church has understood this to be a saint's reflection on the meaningless of life lived without God. But more recently, many have looked at this book and they said, well, you know, this book is actually subversive. And even Christians have said, well, it's somebody playing the devil's advocate. This preacher, they'll say, is an Epicurean. He's teaching selfish indulgence. Or some will say he is the actual very first and original of the existentialist philosophers. One of the ancient rabbis who read Ecclesiastes said, oh, Solomon, where is your wisdom? Not only do your words contradict the words of your father, David, they even contradict themselves. But I would submit to you that God's people who have truly carefully studied this book will realize there is a treasure here. There is a gem here before us. And the author does not endorse unqualified self-gratification. He does not endorse that everything in life is essentially and truly without meaning, as if there were no God. But he's going to be advancing a very engaging argument for this singular fact. Without God, all life is meaningless. Without God, all life is meaningless. So why Ecclesiastes? Why are we going to be looking at this book? Well, let me conclude with three reasons I'm excited about looking at it. First of all, to recognize the meaning of our lives and to live with true purpose. You see, we don't believe that, as existentialists say, that there's no meaning to life except that which you give to it. No. God created this world. God created life with intrinsic meaning. And your purpose, your real goal in life ought to be to discover that purpose, to live out that meaning. And this book will convict us that we are almost certainly all living to some great degree for that which does not matter. If you live, if you open your eyes to this book and come to it honestly, you will be convicted that in some measure, a great deal of your life is lived inconsistent with what you know about God. And that's the purpose, to bring you back to the true meaning and purpose that God has created you for. A second reason I'm excited about looking at this book is to learn the truest perspective on our world. Oh yeah, a biblical kind of realism. We need that. The great American novelist Herman Melville, who wrote Moby Dick, once called Ecclesiastes the truest of all books. And he said that because this book can get pretty dark. It gets pretty dark. If you know, if you've ever read the book, you know what I'm talking about. But that shouldn't surprise you, beloved, because if you live for any amount of time, you know there is a dark side to life. Life can get pretty grim. This book gives us a very real portrait of the way things are. Lastly, I'm excited about looking at this book to learn what is the best this world can give us without God. Boy, you need that. Boy, we need that. The great English preacher John Wesley once preached this his way through this great book of the Bible. And in his personal journal, he described what it was like to begin this sermon series. He writes, "Began expounding the book of Ecclesiastes. Never before had I so clear a sight either of its meaning or beauties. Neither did I imagine that the several parts of it were in so exquisite a manner connected together, all tending to prove the grand truth that there is no happiness out of God." Well, we're all well acquainted with the problem of pain. We hate it. It brings us to seek relief and comfort. And with that, we seek for answers. But there's another problem, and it's one here that this author is going to address. It's the problem of pleasure. And those who live their life suffering from pleasure often find themselves in such despair, they despair of life itself. These are the kind of people that tend to commit suicide. They hate life. And what does the Bible have to say for those on the verge of despair? Well, this book has the answers for those that are trapped. And it's a wake-up call. It's a wake-up call to find meaning in God. This book explains the story of a king's quest to find satisfaction for life under the sun. And he came up dry without God. And so, beloved, I trust that the Lord will use this book in the weeks and months to come.